Session number 22371, Reel 2.
John Howe, Reel 2.
Okay, the army training manuals were written by Montgomery. You know, Montgomery had a committee, and they all met. And at the end of the first meeting, he said, well, look, leave it to me, chaps, I'll do it. So he wrote the lot. So the story goes. And he was a bossy old sod, but nonetheless a very, very dedicated soldier. And he had worked out these sort of basic things. When you meet a situation, you've got to sum it up. And you need to do that in a logical way. In a tactical point of view, there would be the hillside and the enemy and the dispositions and particular difficulties. You've got to take all these into account. They are the factors, and then you work out what various alternatives there are, and if one of those becomes your plan, and that's it. Right? If you take it in that sort of fairly logical sequence, which frankly is what you do when you cross the road, if you think about it, but, you know, since it's more complex, you need to sort of make sure you get things in the right categories. And then there's a sequence in which you give orders in the army. The information about own troops and the enemy, intention, method, so on, one bit after another. So you get all the things appertaining to a particular facility or particular item are in under that heading. And it's quite logical. You know? And in times of strain, you need something logical to work to, so that was it. I needed something logical when I, 19, 20-year-old, and there was Major George Foster in charge of training, the second-in-command, and we'd be either out on a hillside somewhere or round a sand table at night, and he would create a situation, and he'd say, Mr. Howe, would you give me your appreciation? And you better bloody well get it in the right order. And I tell you what, I was terrified of him, but I had great respect for him. Unfortunately, he was killed. Because of him, I learnt to respect all these various procedural things for the army. There's certainly appreciation and the method of giving orders was one of them. And what's more, he would make you do it in front of everybody, in front of the whole battery or whole regiment. He'd say, right, give us a sample of your appreciation. Now, what's your appreciation? Tell them, make sure that everybody can hear you, you know, 500 men there listening to it, including your own troop. So you better not make a balls of it. Anyway, and that was him. And he was very good for me, and I'm sure for lots of other people. Unfortunately, he trod on a mine in Normandy and went into the next world. Anyway, when that regiment was disbanded, as I explained a little while ago, we ended up in Northumberland, in Chevy Chase.
Just before you go back to that holding unit, the 90th was equipped with what kind of weapons?
Six-pounder anti-tank guns. We were an anti-tank regiment. The 64-gun regiment, it was called. The army designed. The army realised that anti-tank mattered very much because German tanks made mincemeat of the British army far too frequently. And so anti-tank guns were developed. That might be worth putting down in your recording. Right. Full stop. Let's just go on to this subject of guns. In 1930 or so, the army, or the only thing the army had was what was left over from World War I. They hadn't developed anti-tank. You know, most guns had armour-piercing shot, but it might take you 10 minutes to fire it, to load it and fire it. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't much cop. The machine guns, the ACAP guns, everything we had was pretty ancient. Some of it going back to the Boer War or the Crimea, which they had trials. In 1935, my father came home from India as an observer to the trials, and out of it stemmed the main armament of the British Army, which served us very well. Now, no one in the world had thought of an anti-tank gun. Anyway, out of it, they produced the 2-pounder anti-tank gun. And there's a £2 in, I'm sure, in the Imperial War Museum. If there isn't, there is one in the new Royal Artillery Museum at Woolwich. It was a beautifully engineered. It was designed in peacetime, you know, where there was time to make things look beautiful. And everything, you sat in a seat and you could quickly whistle round 360 degrees. And it was on a tripod. And anyway, it was a very effective gun. And in the retreat to Dunkirk, it knocked German tanks out in large numbers. But of course, they had so many that the few British knocked out didn't actually affect the outcome of the war. Nonetheless, the Germans took war seriously, as you know. And the Germans took war very seriously. And they realized that they had lost a lot of tanks to British anti-tank guns, and out of which they captured a lot of British anti-tank guns. We were the only army in the world that had anti-tank guns, designated for that purpose. And they decided that instead of developing anti-tank guns, they would develop bigger and better tanks. So they increased the armor on their tanks. And the Germans are great engineers. And the next time the British Army came up against the Germans was really a couple of years later in North Africa, the desert. And the German tanks just laughed at the British anti-tank guns. The armor-piercing shot just bounced off it. The army complained bitterly to headquarters in London. Research was all carried out by the Royal Arsenal, which used to be at Woolwich. And there were boffins there, and I met one of them when I was researching my book. And it's very interesting, because you don't always realise what goes on in this world. Anyway, they improved ammunition, and they realised that the two-pounder anti-tank gun, beautiful as it was quite inadequate for knocking out these German monsters. So they produced a six-pounder. It was a very good and effective gun, and frankly, if it was not for the six-pounder, I think we would have lost the Battle of Alamein. Right. It came out in time, just in time for that. Some regiments got it and rushed down there, got into position, not for Alamein, but there was a battle before Alamein, Alam Halfa, where Rommel's forces fell into Montgomery's ambush. And the ambush, six-pounder anti-tank guns, on tanks and on wheels. Mm-hmm. And the anti-tank world had a field day. Rommel couldn't get any more tanks. He couldn't bring stuff across the Mediterranean. He was stuck with what he had. And he hadn't got many. And those people at Bletchley, who did all this, super reported on the fact that Rommel was getting very short of tanks. Because we knocked them out. However, the Germans went back to their drawing books and they put thicker armour on. And they shaped the armour, and they made it very hard, and all the various clever things that they can do. And they then produced the 17-pounder, which was getting a bit big. For a gun that you're wheeling around in the front line, it's a big bastard. It was. Anyway, again, that was a fine gun, and it fired a big round. But the main gun was a 6-pounder anti-tank. That's the gun the British Army really went to town with. And they realised that they couldn't produce any bigger guns because it was quite impractical to get them into the front line to deal with this evil. So they got to work on ammunition. The boffins got to work. And they were quite clever. You see, they can alter the shape of ammunition so that it has a hard tip, or it'll bounce, or one thing or another. Did you do science in school?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Forces. Forces in a gas. And momentum. These are the things that matter with gallery. You have to get the maximum maximum momentum out of the explosion you produce. Right? So, to get the maximum momentum, you need a certain amount of explosive inside the cartridge, and you need an area on which it can bear, and that projects it through the barrel and out. Once you've got it out there, its bulk becomes an encumbrance. Its bulk is slowing it down, you see. But inside the barrel, the bulk is important. So they produced something called sabot, and I can't remember what the word means. It's only a play on words that it's French for shoe. I can draw it.
Well, don't draw it because this is all audio anyway.
Yes, so. Quite okay. Well, look, it had a ring around it like that. There was your shot, yeah? And there's a ring around it, and that ring around it was discarded in flight. Right? So what started off as a sizable shot ended up as a shot not much thicker than that. And if you see a tank that's been knocked out with sabot ammunition, you could stick that in the hole and not have a lot of space. And the inside of the tank would be absolutely destroyed because it penetrated 10 inches of armour and then carried on inside, destroying everything as it ricocheted. And that was a very big breakthrough. And that was only produced just before D-Day. Most people had very little idea what it was all about. And it was another bit of ammunition.
But to come back to your own story, Ottershaw, maybe that would be the best thing.
Okay, righto. So we're up at Ottershaw. And painted the place. You know, we were running around playing soldiers and firing guns and so on. And there was no nightlife. You could walk down to the village pub. It was a long walk. It was always raining. And they asked for volunteers to join an airborne division. And so four of us volunteered. It was as simple as that. To get away from the boredom. And so I joined the 1st Airborne Division. Little knew who I was joining. Rushed down there in a great hurry to join this mighty group.
Was it Salisbury Plain?
No, it was in Lincolnshire. I mean, the army wasn't in conventional places in those days. And the 1st Airborne Division was in towns and villages from Leicester across to Boston, across that area there. 6th Airborne Division was on Salisbury Plain. But there were other divisions. Before D-Day, you know, there were a lot of soldiers who just got parked everywhere. Most of us never saw a barracks from one year to the next. We were in billets. And the battery was spread around the village, and they turned garages into, put a couple of bunks in a garage or something like that. And anyway, they weren't expecting me. I got there. But the battery commander had indented for a couple of new subalterns. Well, that's the way the army did things, you know. He said, I'll have a couple more subalterns. He had some reason why he should. And there were two batteries in the division, two independent batteries. We had no regiment. And they both, obviously the two battery commanders got together and they asked for two more subalterns each. So we, four of us, went off down there. And we joined a very select group, and I realised it very quickly. They were all volunteers to start with, and they were all doing what they wanted to do. Whereas the rest of the army, there were a lot of people who didn't want to do it, and had to be dragged along. But they were there, and they were proud of what they were doing. They could all drive. They knew how to do everything with the guns and the light equipment, the light weapons, Bren guns. Everybody was au fait with everything. They could all ride motorbikes. The battery was about 200 men. And very, very professional. They had gone out to North Africa. They had captured one of the bridges in Sicily for the invasion there, after appalling casualties on the way. They had captured Taranto, which is a big town in southern Italy, and captured Foggia, not on their own. There were other chaps with them, but they had reason to be proud of themselves. And they had come back, and they were all still fairly well tanned from living in the Mediterranean, and had stories of what they had got up to. The US Air Force had dropped them all over the Mediterranean, and about 25% of them were dropped in the sea, gliders or parachutists. About another 25% at least were dropped, scattered around the Mount Etna in Sicily. For a division to operate effectively when their men are scattered in this fashion. But those who were out at sea, it was anything up to 5 miles out. And it wasn't just a question of wading ashore. A lot were drowned. But a lot survived.
So what kind of reception did you get when you joined them?
Oh, bloody hell, here comes another one. Words to that effect. Very non-committal, I think. You know. Anyway, they were all very decent chaps, but quite wrapped up in themselves. And I went with this other guy, and we became LOs, liaison officers. And that's an army term for a bloke who can be used for any odd job you feel like giving him, the higher command demand. And I hadn't been there very long before one of the troop commanders was seriously injured. And I was put in charge of his troop. And that suited me.
Which troop was this?
It was a troop of 17 pounder guns. A troop is 4 guns. So a troop of 4 guns, about 30 men. Anyway, that didn't work out because about, I don't know, 10 days later some bloke arrived and was given that troop, and I was put in charge of another troop, which was a 6-pounder troop. Well, this is an LO's life anyway, you know, to do this. So it sort of went on.
What was the name of the unit within the division?
1st Air Landing Anti-Tank Battery. All right.
And then what happened?
D-Day came and went. We couldn't believe it. General Montgomery had brought us all the way back to the Mediterranean, and he didn't throw us in against the Germans and on that coastline. And we thought, well, it'll happen any day now. Well, there was one operation after another was planned, and I'm told there were 17 planned, and they were cancelled until Arnhem. Anyway, round about the beginning of August, I can't remember which day, the battery commander just said to me over lunch, perhaps you'd drop in and see me this afternoon in the most casual way. So I went down and he said, right, tomorrow morning I want you to take the B echelon to Normandy. That's how things work, you know. No question of get it ready, get it organised. Just, it'll be there, you just take it. I had arranged for a girl to come over and stay in the village we were in. It's a little village in Lincolnshire. She arrived that night, I had to tell her a cock and bull story, and she went back home. She was young enough to believe anything, I think. And early next morning we set off for Normandy. And that was the sheer effort of getting to Normandy, I suppose, was enough. We had to drive. in an enormous convoy, the B echelon from the whole division. The echelon, the A echelon is the fighting unit. The echelon is the first sort of support unit behind it. And the C echelon is very much what comes up behind. That's how it divides up. And there might even be a D echelon, I don't know. But anyway, eventually the battery got split up in all sorts of different places and had to congregate again. Anyway, I took the B echelon to Normandy. And it was quite an experience. We loaded up in some docks in London. And we pulled out in the evening. And it was quite exciting, going to war. And suddenly the ship stopped off Southend. And we stayed there for 48 hours. Quite an anticlimax. But it made a difference. I'll say 48 hours, it was long enough, whatever it was. We then chugged down through one night, because after the Germans still held the Pas de Calais, you know, so they obviously were concerned about the guns there. So we went down by night, and we came off the famous beaches at Normandy, and you know, it was like a regatta. There were ships as far as you could see, in every direction, and all lots of traffic in between them. And there was a hospital ship nearby with red crosses and all, you know. And dance music was coming out of it. You know, we're going to war, but there's dance music. And it was always somewhat incongruous. But anyway, there we were. Anyway, in no time at all the various vehicles and everything came out of the hold and went into the landing craft, and we went down nets into the landing craft and went ashore onto a sandy beach. And through some sand dunes, frankly, because of the sand that was kicked up, all you could see was the white tapes which marked the route through it. And you could only sort of see them just down here. The rest was a complete fog. Until suddenly we came out of the sand dunes into lush countryside. Rather like the south of England. Mm-hmm. And when I'd made sure that all the vehicles, I had about a dozen vehicles, two guns, a lot of small arms, and about, I don't know, a dozen men, two men, that's really more than that, about 20 men. And once I knew they were all ashore and we all lined up, we realised that there was a naffy wagon in the corner of the field. This is going to war, you see, naffy wagon. So we went over there and had a tea and a cake, chai and a wad. And next to the naffy wagon was a grave of a fellow from the Pioneer Corps who'd been killed on D-Day. And I often wondered, what the hell was he doing there on D-Day? The Pioneer Corps was not an assault. Well, obviously he was some sort of assault team. But, it's an interesting fact. Anyway, we then went off to some place where the division spread it around itself around various fields. You know, the vehicles had to be camouflaged against hedges and things like this. And there was a conference which we told that the operation that we had gone across for, which was, in the end we found out, was something on the road to Paris, a place called Rambouillet, where they hold conferences now, don't they? Anyway, an airborne operation was no longer necessary, but what had been planned. So that's why we went to Normandy. And they said, well, you're going to be here for a week or 10 days. And we were. Now, I floated around in Normandy. I made the most of it. Normandy was a small, confined area. You see, until the real big breakout, right? You know, it was just like a park, if you like, a big park for that matter. And I had friends all over the army, and I just kept meeting them, and it was great. And I met some old school friend, whose name I can't remember now, who was on Montgomery's staff, and he took me up to one of Montgomery's caravans and showed me all the maps, and this is where your operation was going to be, and the pity was cancelled, and we're planning another one over this way, and so on and so on. It's very interesting. visited the Bayeux Cathedral and saw the Bayeux Tapestry. That's about all there was to see in Bayeux, as far as I remember, the cobble streets. And in no time at all, we took off to go up through France, because by that time, you know, the German collapse had started. Then being, I suppose, well, the end of August, anyway. Before we knew it, we came to Seine, which is quite a wide river at that point, and they had a pontoon bridge. If you can imagine, there's all these boats, one after another. So, as you drive along, so the boat you're over sinks. So then you drive uphill to the next one, and that one sinks. So you spend the whole time going uphill. It's quite an interesting experience. We then ended up in some little town and stayed there for about 24 hours, I remember. France was enjoying itself. You know, they were celebrating. And everybody wanted to celebrate. Then we entered into this village and they all wanted to celebrate. They'd all hidden wine and things like this in trunks in their gardens. So when the Germans came through and they dug them out and they intended to drink it. And they invited us to join them. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And all of a sudden, it was time to move on. And we then moved up through... I went on one of the fastest convoy rides I've ever been in my life. And we went up through... what do you call the... There was a salient in the First World War. A tremendous number of casualties. It's only just over the coast in France. Passchendaele. We went up that way. And I can remember at some point where in every direction you looked there were lines of graves to the horizon. It was a sobering thought. And didn't really want to linger particularly, but you know, it was there they were, and immaculately kept and so on, all dead straight lines. We flogged on then and entered Belgium and ended up in some village just outside of Louvain and parked ourselves in a farmyard and awaited the next orders. In then being the first week of September, something like that. And I must have been told about the Arnhem operation. I don't remember being told about it. I don't remember receiving instructions.
You were with still with the B echelon at Louvain?
B echelon, yeah.
In charge of it?
Yeah, yeah. In charge of the battery part of it. I mean, every unit in the division had part of it in the B echelon. And we had everybody's kit, and we had loads of spare ammunition and guns and all sorts of things. It was meant to reinforce the main unit, which went in by air, and did go in by air. Anyway, we left this place near Louvain, and we went up, and the Arnhem operation started, and I saw the Americans landing, the American 101st. It was just sort of just like over there. So all these planes came over, you know, the sky was filled with planes and the sun glinted on the parachutists. It was quite a nice day. And they all came down. And we were parked on the side of the road. And many hours later, we were still parked on the side of the road. And I don't know how long we stayed there, but too bloody long, something like a day or two. Because the Germans had reacted a bit too fast, and the Guards Armoured Division had not gone through in the way which is history. And later on, when I drove through, I realised why, because there was sort of a battery of German 88s, which is the famous gun, which had been destroyed, but you could see the ruins all around the place. And that's what held it up. We then... I don't know, time gets lost a bit in this. The name of that fellow in Essex is Atkinson, Herbie Atkinson. Now, we went up, we went through Eindhoven. Oh, that's right, before that, the Germans attacked the column that we were in, and we deployed the anti-tank guns, but they were dealt with further up the road. You know, they didn't come near where we were, but we were ready for them. Anyway, while we were parked there, the 43rd Wessex